Hello and welcome to the In Focus podcast. I'm G. Sampath, the Hindu's social affairs editor. On 12th June 2020, an internal working group was set up by the Reserve Bank of India to review the current licensing and regulatory guidelines regarding ownership and control of banks in India. When this working group's report was shared on the RBI website last week for comments, it emerged that the biggest recommendation was that corporate houses should be allowed to own and operate banks. Interestingly, former RBI Governor Raghuram Rajan and former RBI Deputy Governor Viral Acharya have written a blog post titled, "Do We Really Need Indian Corporations in Banking?" In their post, they basically tear apart the RBI report, asking what is the need to open up the banking sector to corporate houses now? Is there anything new that we know now that we didn't know already for us to change our guidelines? So, why then is the RBI interested in allowing corporate houses into banking? What are the risks involved? Are Rajan and Acharya overreacting by any chance? And how are things likely to pan out if the recommendations do get implemented? To answer these questions, we have with us Vivek Kaul, well-known business columnist and author of 5 books, including the best-selling Easy Money trilogy. His most recent book is called Bad Money, Inside the NPA Mess and How It Threatens the Indian Banking System. Vivek, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Sampath, for having me over.
Okay, Vivek, to start with, can you give us a quick historical rundown of the banking licensing regimes India has had so far and what has been the trend like?
Sure. So, you know, let me just go back a little in history. And at the time of independence, we only had private banks. And then in 1955, the Imperial Bank of India was nationalized and we got what is now known as the State Bank of India. In 1969, 14 banks, which with deposits of over 50 crore, which controlled around 85% of the deposits in the system, along with SBI, were nationalized. In 1980, six more banks were nationalized, banks which had, I think, deposits of more than 200 crore. So, as of 1980, the SBI and the other nationalized banks controlled close to 91% of the Indian banking system. So, largely in the early 90s, we were a banking system which was largely owned by the government. There were obviously a lot of small private banks around, particularly in the southern part of the country. In 1991, the Narasimhan Committee, the first Narasimhan Committee, which was called the Committee on Financial Sector Reforms, essentially recommended the opening up of the Indian banking system. And by opening up, I mean allowing private players into it. So in 1993, around 113 applications for private banks to get a license to operate a private bank were received by the RBI. And out of that, 10 got a license. Now, these include, banks like there is ICICI, HDFC Bank, IndusInd Bank, Axis Bank. But I mean, Axis Bank originally got its license under the name UTI Bank. So these were basically the large, the development financial institutions which got licenses. Then there was Global Trust Bank. Then there was a bank called Development, DCB Credit Bank, which was a cooperative bank and it became a scheduled commercial bank. So 93, 10 licenses were given. The capital requirement, was around 100 crore. Then again in 2003, 2004, 2 licenses were given, one to Yes Bank, another to Kotak, Mahindra Bank. In 2013-14, 2 more licenses were given, one to what is now IDFC First Bank and the other is the Bandhan Bank. So largely, if you look at the situation, RBI has not been very proactive when it comes to giving out new banking licenses. And obviously, it has its reasons for the same. Also, you know, one needs to take into account the fact that, the licenses that it gave in 93-94, some of the banks do not exist. One bank was Times Bank, which got merged into HDFC Bank. Then there were two banks. One was called the Bank of Punjab. The other was called the Centurion Bank. The Centurion Bank and Bank of Punjab first merged, and then that bank merged into HDFC Bank. The Global Trust Bank went bust, and it was merged into the Oriental Bank of Commerce. So a lot of these banks which first got licenses don't exist anymore. Yeah. So that is, I guess, the broad story of, the licensing regime in India, the banking licensing regime in India.
Okay. So this RBI working group's report in its justification for thinking of reviewing and changing the guidelines, it says that we need to bring different. It says different banks are probably working under different kinds of licensing guidelines under which they got the license, and there is a need to rationalize all of them, and we need to get more players to increase competition and so on and so forth. So broadly speaking, what is the current regime of guidelines for issuing licenses, and what is the limit on corporate ownership stakes and so on?
So the limit on corporate ownership, as a promoter is 15%, and if your ownership is more than 15%, then you need to dilute it over a period of time. So currently, as a promoter, you cannot own more than 15% of a bank. Which is why a lot of NBFCs, which can easily convert themselves into a bank, do not want to become a bank, because then they'll have to, the promoters will have to lower their ownership.
So coming finally to the actual recommendations of this working group, I mean, what are they actually saying? What do they want to change? Apart from one we know is that they want corporate officers to be allowed to own banks and run them. So what are the, broadly speaking, the context, and what is it that they're pushing for?
So essentially, I think there are three main points, and there are a lot of sub points, but there are three main points which I think the general audience should be interested in. The first point is that the cap on promoters' stake in the long run of 15 years may be raised from the current level of 15% to 26% is one recommendation. The second recommendation, as you pointed out, is the fact that large corporates / industrial houses may be allowed to become promoters of banks. The third point is that well-run large non-banking financial companies essentially may be considered for conversion into banks. Now, these are the three main points which the internal working group of the RBI has suggested in its report.
Okay. Basically, in response to these three main recommendations, we've got two really eminent bankers who know what they're talking about, and they have criticized the report, basically, Raghuraman Rajan and Viral Acharya, and they've said it's a bombshell. Yeah. Well, that's a very powerful way of describing what the working group report is suggesting. So what do they mean by bombshell, and what are their objections?
Right. I mean, they've sort of put forward quite a few points. The first question they ask is, which you used in your introduction as well, as to why now, and, basically, what has changed now that we should suddenly be allowing corporates into banking after not allowing them all this while? And I think the most important point here is that this could essentially lead to a big conflict of interest. Any industrial house and a large industrial house constantly needs finance. It needs money to keep operating, and if you give them if you allow them to operate a bank, you're essentially giving them a permanent and a cheap source of finance. Now, whether they will use the bank to carry out banking activities, or whether they'll use the bank to essentially carry out to finance their own business is the billion-dollar question. So the way Rajan and Acharya put it, and I mean I have no reason to sort of not use their words, because they've put it in very clear terms. So what they say is that industrial houses need financing, which they can get easily, no questions asked, if they have an in-house bank. The history of such connected lending is invariably disastrous. How can the bank make good loans when it is owned by the borrower? So clearly, the incentive itself is not right. The second point they make is, they essentially say that easy access to financing via an in-house bank will further exacerbate the concentration of economic power in certain business houses. So, which basically means that, a lot of India's large business houses are into many, many different businesses. If you give them, if you allow them to run a bank as well, the kind of control they will have over the economy will go up even further. So, I think these are two very strong reasons, and they cannot be ignored.
No, but even if you allow them to come into banking, you will continue to have the RBI and probably other regulators looking in and supervising and monitoring, because they, at the end of the day, there are norms for how much capital you hold, how much you can lend, and exposure limits and so on. So aren't these norms and regulations and monitoring adequate to make sure that these guys, they do stick to the straight and narrow path of lending, correctly and so on?
If you look at the way RBI has operated in the past, you can say that it has been very good at cleaning up once something disastrous has happened. But when it comes to preventing disasters, the RBI really hasn't been up to the mark. And there are reasons for it. I'll give you a recent example. Take the example of Yes Bank. As late as December 2019, their bad loans rate was less than 5%. And the market essentially knew that, they're not reporting the number properly. And the market hammered the stock price. Whereas after the bank was rescued and when the real numbers sort of came out, you came to know that as of March 2020, the bad loans rate of Yes Bank was close to 19-20%. So essentially, a fifth of their of the loans that they had given had not been repaid for a period of 90 days or more. Now, what does that tell you? It tells you, obviously, this situation for Yes Bank didn't go bad in a period of 3 months from December 2019 to March 2020. What that tells you is that they were lying. The similar thing happened with ILNFS. The ILNFS mess, we still haven't been able to sort out. It's been more than 2 years. So I think, if a banker is determined enough to hide his books, he can do so for a large period of time. You can't expect the RBI to, inspect everything and all the, all the papers and it can only, build a system and hope that people follow that system, and over a period of time that system works and it has largely. So but the point is, you will always get such deviants who will get around to beating the system. Also, you need to take into account the fact that RBI is not a truly independent body. There is constantly a lot of pressure on it from the Department of Financial Services. Now, how much pressure the institution faces and how much pressure they give into depends on the governor who is at the helm of things. There is a as Rajan and Acharya write, and I'd like to quote them, and then they say that can the regulator not discriminate between fit and proper business and shady ones? It can, but it has to be truly independent with a thoroughly apolitical board. Whether these conditions will always pertain is debatable. I mean, obviously, you know, this is an indirect way of saying that the current RBI board is not thoroughly apolitical. The other example, you know, if you look at the current bad loans mess, the signs of bad loans started to come out as early as 2011, but the RBI crackdown only began in 2014, you know, when after Dr. Rajan became the RBI governor. For the first couple of years, the RBI actually was helping banks by coming up with regulations and in order to ensure that banks could kick their bad loans can down the road. Point here is that too many things which essentially go against the RBI being able to operate the way it should.
So given these various risk factors which are involved, I mean, where do you think this whole idea of letting corporates into banking is coming from? Is it driven by, say, a desperation to find bidders for public sector banks, which may be in the pipeline to be privatized? Is that one factor which
See, I mean, I really don't know where this is coming from, but I mean, that could be a possible factor. Here's the thing. You know, what has happened is that in the aftermath of the COVID pandemic, the tax revenues of the government have collapsed totally. And I mean, the only tax that it's currently, making more of than it did last year is essentially excise duty. And that's also primarily because the excise duty on petrol and diesel has been increased majorly during the course of this year. So the government obviously needs to look at other avenues of earning money. And, one avenue obviously is selling stakes in public sector enterprises that it owns. Now, the problem is, at the same time, we have a narrative of Atmanirbharta which is being promoted. So if you want to sell, let's say, half a dozen public sector banks, I mean, you obviously need players with a decent amount of money who are in a position to buy these banks. You might expect big banks like an HDFC or even an ICICI to buy one or two of these banks. Even if they buy more, there is very little competition. So you need probably a little more competition to buy these banks, and that can only happen if you allow, let's say, you give a license to a large corporate, and at the same time have a at the same time put the smaller public sector banks on the block, so that the corporate does not have to start right from scratch. It can just pick up one of the banks and go about its business. Also, when it comes to public sector banks, they have, the infrastructure necessary to roll out a banking business is already in place. So you don't have to start from scratch. So that could be a possible reason, but whether it is the reason, I really don't have much idea of that. So
no, but if this logic is at play, wouldn't it be a better approach to let the public own shares in the public sector banks? I mean, why does it have to be sold to a...
That is the thing, I have constantly advocated that the government should run public sector banks as an investor and not as a business. So what that means is that the government holding in these banks needs to come down to 33%. So at that level, they have, they'll most likely, along with... the likes of LIC and other government-owned financial institutions, they'll still have, majority control in the bank. But you will have to let the bankers run the bank, the way they want to, instead of the way the government and the Department of Financial Services wants it to. Now, the problem here is then what happens to the social objectives of the government, because public sector banks, the constant, the moment you criticize the performance of public sector banks on the social media, a lot of new age public sector bankers tend to jump on you saying that, oh, but we have to fulfill the social sector obligations as well, which is true. The point is then what happens to the social objectives? So I'll give you a, you know, I mean, I was just looking at some numbers, and it's very interesting that the market capitalization of Kotak Mahindra Bank is 3.82 lakh crore, whereas the market capitalization of State Bank of India is just 2.16 lakh crore. Kotak Mahindra Bank is a puny bank, very small bank in comparison to the State Bank. The market cap of HDFC Bank, which is the most expensive bank in India, is 7.88 lakh crore. Now, assume that all the government-owned banks are properly run, and obviously, you know, their market capitalization will be much higher than it currently is, and the government can easily fulfill its social sector obligations by you know, selling you know, some amount of shares in these banks every year and spending that money towards the social service obligations. But you know, for all this to happen, there is a mindset change that is required in the heads of the babus who run the bank, and that is not going to happen. So
right, let's come back to this point later in the podcast, Vivek. Now, coming back to the banking licensing recommendations. So one of them is to allow NBFCs with an asset base of 50,000 crores to convert into banks. I mean, what according to you are the risks involved in this? I mean, is it a good idea?
See, I think what is happening here is that some of the NBFCs have become too big, and I guess the RBI wants to rein them in a little, and that is only possible if you convert them into a bank. Given that, as you know, as a bank, NBFC, as a bank, you need to maintain a CRR, cash reserve ratio. You need to invest in government securities and stuff like that. So what has happened is that, you know, post demonetization in November 2016, the deposits of public sector banks suddenly went up quite a lot, and they were not able to lend it out that quickly. So what that means is that they were paying interest on the deposits, but you know, they were not able to lend that money out and earn interest on the loans. So what happened was that public sector banks started suddenly giving you know, loaning out a lot of money to NBFCs, and this has you know, jumped from almost around 3.91 lakh crore as of March 2017 to 8.07 lakh crore as of March 2020. So in a period of 3 years, it's gone up quite a lot. So essentially what happens now is that the risk of NBFCs is also has sort of been the risk of an NBFC or NBFCs not doing well has been transferred onto the books of banks. And as we've seen, you know, some of the, you know, NBFCs like Dewan Housing and ILNFS have not done well in the recent past. So I think if you take all this information into consideration, and the fact that a deputy governor of the RBI recently made a long speech on this particular issue, I think the RBI is just trying to bring down the risk in the system a little by encouraging large NBFCs to convert into banks. In fact, so I think this is coming more from that rather than, you know, basically handing a license, a banking license to a large corporate.
So overall, you think it's not a bad idea as such?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the point is, I mean, see, NBFCs are essentially shadow banking. You know, they lack, the transparency is not as good as a bank. The lending is risky, and if they grow beyond a certain size, the amount of damage they can do to a financial system if they fail is tremendous. So it makes sense, I think, for larger NBFCs to be, I mean, either converted into a bank or simply reined in. I mean, you cannot have NBFCs which are bigger than banks. I mean.
Fine. Moving on to the next recommendation, which is about payments bank being allowed to turn into a full-fledged bank. Huh. Is this a good idea, or especially, you know, if they become a full-fledged commercial bank, they would be able to give out loans and so on. And the other alternative is, of course, to let them tie up with a normal bank and then make loans and share the profits. So which do you think is a better way forward for payment banks?
So, you know, I think Rajan and Acharya criticized this move. And I'm interpreting what they have said here, and I mean, I have no way of knowing whether they really mean it, the way I am interpreting it. I think what is happening is that if you look at payment banks' licenses, some of the licenses are currently with large corporates. So, which is why I think they are a little, you know, when, you know, they are not comfortable with the idea of payments banks being converted into normal banks. And which is why they suggest that, you know, a payment bank can tie up with a, you know, with another bank and go about its business. So the issue here is that, you know, this could be another way, you know, it could be a backdoor entry for a large corporate to own a bank. Have a proper policy on so.
So just to rephrase what I mean, just tell me if I understand this right. So there seem to be, apart from the main recommendation of, you know, allowing corporates through the front door, as it were, by allowing them to, you know, own and run bank, there seem to be two back doors here. One is the back door of corporate houses which already own NBFCs. Right. You allow those NBFCs to become a bank, right, and that's one back door. And the other is corporates who already own a payments bank, and then you allow the payments bank to become a full-fledged bank. That's the other backdoor. Right. So, and in both these cases, I mean, if you look at the context where India already has a huge pile of NPAs, okay, and the bulk of these NPAs are from corporate defaults, okay, that's number one. And number two, there is a history of corporates which own NBFCs. Okay, lending to related entities via their NBFC subsidiaries. Right. So we have a clear track record of what corporates have done when they own NBFCs, and we have this corporate default context as well. So in this context, it seems like a really bad idea to let corporates into banking, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the risk is just too high. I mean, if you know, even if one of these corporate-owned banks sort of does not do well, I mean, the cost that the system will have to bear will just be tremendous.
Okay, so given that India, I mean, at the end of the day, India does need more banking services with all these risks. I mean, we do need more banking services. Our credit to GDP ratio is still quite low. So what, according to you, is the right way forward for a country like India?
So, you know, I was, you know, since you sort of talk about the you know, credit to GDP ratio, I mean, I was looking at it in the morning today, and credit to GDP ratio vis-a-vis banks, I mean, the amount of money banks have given with respect to the size of the Indian economy. And it is very, very interesting that it is not just low, it has also been falling. Okay. The credit to GDP ratio of Indian banks peaked in 2013-14 at around 53.4%. And since then, it has fallen. And in 2019-20, it was around 51%. Now, what is happening here? This is very interesting. So, there are two things. One is the fact that the per capita income has slowed down in the last 5-6 years. So, you know, when that happens, obviously, the rate of borrowing cannot continue at the same pace. Continue to grow at the same pace. The second thing that I think has happened is the fact that public sector banks, because they sort of overlent between 2008 and 2011, and then they had to sort of take a sort of breather, and they have not been in a position to lend like the way they used to, because they're still afraid of probably, you know, the loans being turning into NPA. So how do you handle a situation like this where you cannot give loans to where you cannot give banking license to large corporates, given the fact that you know, one, the past experience has not been good, and two, I mean, if you look at the entire bad loans mess, the total amount of domestic bad loans peaked as of March 2018, and the amount of bad loans in the domestic bad loans in the system was close to 9.62 lakh crore. Okay. Of this, around 73.2% or 7.04 lakh crore were defaults made by loans to the industry sector, and around 1.23 lakh crore were defaults made by loans to the services sector. So the point being that, close to more than three-fourths of the defaults were made by corporates. So, you cannot, in this situation, you cannot, give out a loan, give out a banking license to corporates. That is a given. So how do you handle this situation? So you handle this situation, as I said earlier, by letting public sector banks being run by their managers and not by the babus sitting at, in the Department of Financial Services. They should be allowed to raise more capital, because right now a lot of them are short on capital, and the more the moment they have more capital, they will be, their ability to lend will grow. The second thing that needs to be done is that every public sector bank should not be giving out large corporate loans or loans for project finance. Some of the public sector banks should just stick to, retail business. I mean, take a bank like Bank of Maharashtra, which has got a very strong retail franchise in the state of Maharashtra. Now, there is no reason that this, the Bank of Maharashtra should also do project loans or corporate loans. So the smaller sector, public sector banks should stick to retail and probably SMEs and stuff which they can handle at their local level, and the larger ones should then be allowed to do corporate finance and project finance and stuff like that. So there are, it's not that India does not have enough banks. Okay. We still have if you look at even after all the mergers of public sector banks, we still have close to 12 public sector banks. If you look at private banks, there are 10, new private banks, new generation private banks, and there are a whole host of old private sector banks. Then there are a lot of foreign banks. So I don't think the problem is with the number of banks. The problem is with the fact that a lot of public sector banks in the last decade have not been in a position to take an adequate amount of risk while lending. And that is the problem we need to solve. I mean, just giving out more banking licenses is not going to help.
So given these three basic points which you've beautifully explained, one is, of course, three-fourths of the defaults, NPAs right now are from corporates, number one. Number two, PSUs should be run by managers and not by babus, and the government should run the PSUs as an investor and not as a business. And finally, public sector banks should be sort of empowered to be able to lend more and not necessarily try and increase the total number of banks, because we already have a large number of banks. And is there anything else you would like to add?
Yeah, before the public sector banks merged, we had 27 public sector banks, right? So the infrastructure, now we have only 12 public sector banks, but the infrastructure of 27 public sector banks is still there. So, and that's a large number. I mean, it's not a small number by any stretch of imagination. So,
thank you so much, Vivek, for joining us and sharing your insights.
Thanks, Sampath, for having me.
InFocus will be back soon with analysis of the biggest news issues. In the meantime, you can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other platforms. Just search for InFocus by The Hindu. We'll see you soon.